Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
These boys were out on an adventure and they came across this body and they alerted the police, and when the authorities came, they, you know, saw that she was dressed in her maid's outfit and in a coat.
In 1928, Bay of Plenty woman Elsie Walker disappeared from Papamoa. Days later, her body turned up in Auckland. I'm Jesse Mulligan, and you're listening to Crimes NZ, a podcast where we hear from people closest to some of New Zealand's most notorious crimes. In this episode, crime author Scott Bainbridge tells Charlotte Ryan about one of the oldest cold cases in Aotearoa.
I grew up in the 1970s, and you know that was the era of the motorised offender, and you know Mona Blades and the Korean murders, that they were the, you know, the ultimate mysterious unsolved murders. But for a generation before that, for many, many years, it was the mysterious death of Elsie Walker. So Elsie was a 17-year-old girl who lived in on the East Cape, in a little remote hamlet called Rokokori, which is just up the coast from Tikaha. And her older sister had the benefit, like a lot of children in that era, that the older children had the benefit of a secondary education. And her older sister spent some time in Auckland and regaled tales of Elsie, of Auckland, you know, to Elsie. And she, all she wanted to do was to go to Auckland to become a dressmaker, but her father forbade it because she wasn't really that great academically. But she rebelled, but a concession was reached, and Elsie was able to go to Papamoa, where her father's sister had married into an affluent farming family. And she was to work as a housemaid for her relatives, for her cousins. But when she actually got there, she found that she was treated like nothing more than a slave. She never had her own bedroom. She lived on an annex off the main bedroom of her aunt and uncle. And yeah, she was treated like a slave by her relatives, including, you know, her five male cousins.
And what era are we talking? It's like the early 20s, isn't it?
Yeah, we're talking about the mid to late 1920s, where it was, you know, girls back then didn't really, go into any profession other than, work in a factory or work as a housemaid, and it was a lot of girls from that era. That's what they did until they, you know, found husbands.
Yeah. So she moved from Gisborne or the East Cape to Papamoa. She was a housemaid. Did they still treat her with respect?
No, and you know, I had access to the police files, which is some of the biggest files I've ever seen in my life, because they're contained in 12 boxes, and it's, you know, massive. And so I went through all of the papers, and certainly a lot of the witness statements, including the family themselves, say that they mistreated Elsie. She was allowed to eat with them, but then, you know, her daily task was to look after the 3-year-old, and then her auntie, who was Constance Bailey, who was a loved her place in high society. So she basically had to follow her auntie around from, you know, morning tea to morning tea, and just sit there in the corner. So she, you know, if she had hoped for some sort of lease of freedom, she was sadly mistaken.
Oh, that's really sad. So then tell me what happened after that, because she disappeared really randomly, didn't she?
Yeah, well, a few unusual things happened in the days before she disappeared, and that she was acting a little bit oddly. She had hit her head on a window while she was cleaning the window and had to sit down. And her aunt claimed later that, you know, after that she would just sort of daze into space. But on the night she disappeared, there was nothing unusual. The family were hosting a relative, a young woman of Elsie's age, who had come down from Auckland and regaled sort of stories about seeing Charles Kinsett Smith, you know, land his plane. And Elsie had to do the washing up, and she was a little bit, I guess, perhaps embarrassed or jealous even. And she certainly seemed to be acting a little bit oddly. And that night she was last seen putting the scraps of rubbish outside. And one of her older cousins was coming home from a dance, and he noticed the family vehicle wasn't placed in its garage. And so he didn't really think too much of it until the next morning when they woke up and found that Elsie had disappeared as well as the car. It was regarded, you know, quite oddly because, you know, Elsie couldn't drive. There was no, apart from her behaviour, it was her odd behaviour. It was thought that maybe she got a little bit of, felt a little bit jealous and then stole the family car and driven to Auckland. And sure enough, the vehicle was found the next day in Panmure, and then a day later, her body was found in bush bush near Mount Wellington. Now, you know, back then in 1928, Panmure and Mount Wellington were very, very much rural areas. They're not built up, wasn't built up. So, you know, the vehicle was found, the tyre had been changed. And Elsie certainly, really odd. And
who found her body? Sorry to interrupt.
It was just two boys who were out. The area where her body was found was great big fields and bush. And so, you know, these boys were out on an adventure and they came across this body, and they alerted the police. And when the authorities came, they saw that she was dressed in her maid's outfit and a coat, and which was odd for that time because, you know, anybody that wanted to go out of the family home, whatever class you're in or whatever city you lived in, you would always dress up in your Sunday best. So it was regarded that this was quite unusual for this housemaid to be still found in her housemaid's outfit. But there was no outward signs of violent death. There was like a 10-cent size bruise to her forehead. That was the only sign of any injury. So, they took the body back, and they initially thought that maybe she had hit her head or maybe she had ingested some sort of poison. Mm-hmm. And certainly that was the view for a wee while. But just the whole manner of her disappearance was just out of character, you know, because she couldn't drive. So she would have taken the car, if that theory holds.
And driven a long way, Panmure to Papamoa, yeah.
Well, you know, the Kaimais were impassable at that stage. It took often on a rainy day, it took often a day to pass. So she would have had to have gone to Rotorua and then up. And, you know, the Bombays were fared, you know, less better because, you know, it was really a dirt track. So, you know, this girl who had never driven before, had never been to Auckland before, had no reason to go to Auckland because she knew no one there. You know, and furthermore, she was dressed in a maid's outfit, which she wouldn't have done. Her body arrives.
Yeah, and you mentioned the tyre. Someone had changed the tyre.
And somebody changed the tyre, yeah.
Okay. Is there anything else we need to know about the body? I mean, not going into too much detail, but there was no sort of sign of a sexual attack or anything like that?
Not at that stage. I mean, the police went with the theory that perhaps she'd driven off in a fit of jealousy and banged her head, changed the tyre, banged her head, and then wandered off in a daze and then crawled under the bush and died. And so the police weren't really getting anywhere too fast with that. And then when they received sort of the hurry along from the then commissioner, because by this stage the Truth newspaper were getting involved. Mm. And I need to add here that the Truth newspaper was most people remember as a scandalous rag, but back in the 1920s, it was one of the few newspapers that covered, you know, a lot of information quite thoroughly, even though it was a little bit far-fetched. But the Truth Report and Redmer Esker's book about the Truth mentions that they had some of the most, colourful writers or colourful journalists, and these people were putting together stories. Basically, the Truth Reporter was following the police from door to door, and then they were making up stories as they went. But the stories were, you know, quite dramatic. But And it reached a point where the police weren't getting anywhere with their case, and they brought in a detective called James Bickerdike from Christchurch. Now, Bickerdike was one of those hard-nosed detectives who he was really, at this point in his career, he was really wanting a win because he, in my book, Shot in the Dark, which covers the Elsie Walker case in the chapter beforehand, tells of another unsolved murder of a girl in Christchurch, another housemaid, and Bickerdike, you know, was he couldn't secure a conviction for that murder, and so he was really wanting a victory here, and so he was brought in, and he had a look at the statements of the Baileys, and he actually decided to send Elsie's clothing away for blood analysis, and all of a sudden, one point that the pathologist came back with an addendum to the original statement to say, we believe that Elsie Walker had died as a result of a blow to the head. Now this, I can't begin to say how much this actually surprised the senior police, but it also, it brought in a new track. So they were able to go down the avenue of, okay, so she may have been killed by somebody. Who was it? Elsie's clothing at this stage had come back and found semen stains on her bloomers and blood, which happened in the period immediately before, you know, she disappeared. So forensic science today would be able to confirm who it was, but Bickerdike placed a lot of pressure on the Bailey family, and it was concluded that, you know, the semen had arrived on her bloomers as a result of her skylarking with one of the Bailey boys, you know, her cousins. So which one of them it was, you know, no one would admit to. But it changed the whole thing. And so the commission wanted to hurry along. The inquest went ahead. Now, the police decided to close in on one of the five Bailey boys, and that was Bill. Bill Bailey, he was the oldest one, and he was 21 at that stage. And about a month before Elsie disappeared or was killed or died, Bill left in a hurry and moved to Auckland because Bill was the local ladies' man. He was also a bit of a troublemaker. And he got his 15-year-old neighbour pregnant. And so he basically escaped to Auckland with the help of his mother. And set up there, they tried to set him up on a farm. Now, there was a thought that Bill may have, you know, somehow come back to Papamoa because he was, at this stage, his father had kind of disinherited him for when he found out about the scandal. So he was left to his own devices and he didn't have work. And so it was thought that, you know, he might have snuck back on the train overnight. And because at that stage, the main trunk railway went straight through the Bailey's property in Papamoa. So as it slowed down, he could have jumped off, got into the house and grabbed the car. But he also there was money missing from the Bailey household, so as well as some of the jewellery. Yet Elsie's purse with her meagre savings in it was still on the table. So Bickerdike came up with a theory that maybe Elsie, while she was cleaning the rubbish, had caught Bill outside and Bill was robbing the house, looting the house, and perhaps there's a confrontation and then he hit her. And because the other interesting aspect to that is that where the car was found was pretty close to where Bill had first moved to Auckland a month earlier. So the inquest went for a week, and it was, by this stage, it was really high profile. And Bill took the stand, and he must have thought that he was on trial for his life because, you know, the Vincent Meredith, who was the Crown prosecutor at that stage, was pretty relentless in his cross-examination and had to be held back by the magistrate to say, hey, look, this isn't a murder trial, this is an inquest, we need to find out the cause of death.
What did he say?
Bill had a number of alibis, and mainly from his wife, his new wife, as well as other people. But later it came out that people couldn't confirm the date that they did see Bill. So it was a little bit airy-fairy, but certainly at that time they, you know, were regarded with credence. And, you know, the whole sort of theory that Bill might have killed his cousin, if there was a sexual motive, you know, people were very conservative back then, and, you know, it was probably doubtful.
Yeah. And what sort of forensic technology did they have back then? Because, my brain is just boggling thinking, well, we'd be able to solve that crime ASAP if it was these days because of our technology. But did they have fingerprints and everything like that back in those days?
They did, and the car was fingerprinted. It was extremely dusty, but they could find no fingerprints on it. And when Elsie was stripped at the morgue, her clothes were put in like a closet, and they stayed there for months until they determined that she didn't die of poisoning, and until somebody came out and thought, hey, we better send the bloomers and the clothes off for forensic testing. But Professor Armitage, who was the government bacteriologist at that stage, who tested for blood and semen analysis, he couldn't really give an accurate guess as to who it was, because the clothes by that stage had dried up. He could confirm that the semen likely would have come from the Baileys, somebody in the Bailey family. But at that stage, still in forensic science, still in its infancy, he couldn't narrow down exactly who.
Oh, my gosh. So did they ever have a funeral for her?
Yep, they did. It was attended by Bill and his father. Bill's father came up, and he put himself in charge of the funeral. She was buried at Purua Cemetery, and Elsie's dad came up from the coast for the day, and then headed back on the train. But the fact that there was death by misadventure just wasn't accepted by the public, and by this stage there's a big furore, and the Minister of Justice lobbied for Parliament to put a commission inquiry to work out how come the police didn't know about or changed their tact about the an accidental death to a possible death by death by a blow to the head. So the police the police went on trial, and they said, well, actually we were floored by the pathologist's change in their opinion, whereas the pathologist said, well, actually we didn't come to that conclusion first because we thought that she had been poisoned. It was only after that we determined she wasn't poisoned that we thought that the only logical sign of an injury there was that small blow to the head, that she must have died from the blow to the head. So the police were under the knife at that stage. Yeah. And so, and all the while, the Truth newspaper, every week, there's a new story. Any little tidbit of information was made and elaborated into this massive story. And I encourage listeners to go into papers past where the Truth in 1928 and 29 is accessible. And if you read week by week the articles about Elsie Walker, and you compare them to, say, the chapter in my book, which I believe is quite comprehensive, there are two very, very different stories, yet both are quite plausible and quite engaging. The Truth paper is highly fictional. And I'll give you an example of a story in that when the police were first searching the area where Elsie was found, they found a Minty wrapper. So, the Minties have been around longer than we have. And it was determined later that one of the Boy Scouts, because there was a Boy Scouts hall sort of quite close by, that one of the Boy Scouts had dropped a Minty wrapper. But when the Truth heard about this, then they made a whole article about, well, poor Elsie Walker was sitting on a picnic blanket, possibly eating a Minty while her killer was, walking around and about to strike her, type thing. And you read that and it's like, wow, that's quite amazing. But, it was all, this whole story was elaborated over this, this innocent Minty wrapper.
Oh my gosh, I feel very sad for this case. Like, she sounds like she was just in a terrible situation, but it went unresolved, didn't it? Like, no one was charged.
No one was charged, and after the commission of inquiry, even a neighbour of Constance Bailey wrote to her to say that I saw Bill Bailey on the train that day. Yet when this woman was interviewed earlier, she said that she didn't hear anything. So Constance went to the police and they set up this type of, this operation in this hotel room. And, back in the day, there was no recording devices. So there's a record in my book where Constance Bailey is talking to this woman, and she's clumsily trying to, induce a bribe out of this woman, and this woman's sort of, standoffish, and and in the meantime the detective is in the closet next door with a notebook trying to write in shorthand a recording of this of this alleged bribery. But
Bill Bailey's mother was trying to bribe the woman who thought she saw Bill Bailey on the train.
Well, this woman was trying to bribe Bill Bailey's mum, and Bill Bailey's mum was up for it, but she got the police involved, and this woman wouldn't come out and say, name a price, but you could tell that Constance was saying, well, what can I do? What do you want me to do? And this woman says, well, you tell me what you want me to do. So it went back and forward like that for about an hour. But when that made the news, the fact that Bill was seen on a train, that resulted in another commission of inquiry where the public by the stage were, you know, there were marches and to Parliament, there were demonstrations in the Civic Square in Auckland, asking the police to reopen Elsie's case.
Oh, really? But so it was quite a big public thing, yeah.
It was massive all around the country. And, you know, Elsie was, a timid 17-year-old girl. So, you know, what she would have made of it, you know, who knows? But she would have been probably quite embarrassed. But the police at that stage couldn't reopen the case. But a law was passed later that if new information came to hand, then the authorities had the, were able to reopen a case, but they couldn't with Elsie. So, she, you know, her case went unsolved for years. But Bill Bailey, I probably need to explain that, you know, even though there was no radio and no TV, people read the newspaper and Bill Bailey's name was mentioned all throughout. And so everybody knew Bill Bailey. And by this stage, he had moved to one of his father's farms, to manage one of the father's farms in Ruawaru, which is just slightly northwest of Huntly, quite a remote area. And Bill had fallen out with his neighbours, Sam and Christabel Lakey, to the point there was a massive feud. And Bill went over one day and had a go at them about something. And Mrs. Lakey accused him of killing Elsie Walker. And we expect the same. And, one day in 1933, farmers in the area noticed that the Lakey's milk hadn't been taken or taken down for collection, and they went to go search the farm for them and found Pet Lakey or Christabel Lakey's body. She'd been beaten to death and her body was laid out in a pond, and they couldn't find Sam Lakey. And they searched for days and days, but some quite astute detectives who'd come down from Auckland searched the garden and the fence line and found burnt bits of was later determined to be Sam Lakey. So in short, what happened was that Sam Lakey may have been shot dead and then his body put in a oil drum and burnt beyond, you know, and so his remains were scattered beyond the farm. And so Bill Bailey was the likeliest suspect. And so, he went to trial and he was indeed found guilty of the double murder and hanged.
Oh, no way. And they didn't open the other case at all, the Elsie Walker case?
No. So effectively that Elsie Walker's case is still unresolved.
Oh, my gosh. There is a turn, the Lakey deaths. So what do you know anything about what the Bailey family did after he murdered his neighbours? You know, did they disown him or was there any, you know, did they turn up to court or support his son?
Well, they did, and Constance Bailey was, you know, at his side all throughout, you know, and she would probably admit up to her dying day that Bill was innocent of everything. Certainly, the Baileys were quite a well-respected family in the wider Papamoa Te Puke community, and the whole scandal, you know, certainly back in the day, they pretty much withdrew into themselves. I know that when I researched the book, I did get in contact with members of Elsie's descendants, or not so much her immediate descendants, but she had three brothers and three sisters. So I contacted some descendants who are quite elderly then, who don't recall Elsie but know all about the case, and, you know, they don't have much love for, you know, the Bailey family, you know, even perhaps to this day.
Right.
They certainly believe that he was guilty. Whereas, you know, there was it's probably unfair to blame Bill for Elsie's death because it was never proved. And as I say, he did have alibis. Some of them, and I certainly believe that the sighting on the train by Mrs. Thompson, the lady next door, was false, and it was only in the end she sold her story to the truth and got quite a bit of money out of it.
Oh, which may have been a lie anyway.
I'd say so, because Bill would have come, if Bill had killed Elsie, he would have come on the overnight train in the dead of night, which was a goods train. He would have easily been able to stow aboard, whereas Mrs. Thompson and Mrs. Langdon, the two sisters, they claim to have seen Bill, you know, at some point during a day, a couple of days before. Mrs. Langdon, when she was interviewed, first denied it, but then after meeting up with her sister, then told truth that, no, he definitely was on the train because I saw him first.
Oh, my gosh. It's so uncomfortable thinking how sad this is and that he was never charged or that, you know, no one was ever charged for her death. You know, there's a lot of cases that sometimes get reopened years and years on. Is this case, could it ever be reopened, do you think?
Oh, look, I don't think so. No. Certainly, you know, reading the police file, you know, they did everything in their power to get to the bottom of it. And I'm not saying that Detective Bickerdike, you know, resorted to, you know, anything untoward. He was just looking for a different angle because the original theory was just so far-fetched. Yet, it wasn't logical. So, you know, they had to go down a different tact. And placing pressure on the Bailey family certainly opened up more avenues of inquiry. If Elsie's killer was alive today, which I seriously doubt, then I still think that the case wouldn't be reopened. You know, so much time has passed. You know, Elsie's bloomers and her clothing, I've got photos of that in my book, but they are still held at archives. In fact, the police museum may have them now, but, you know, you wouldn't be able to get anything from them. But certainly if that scenario happened today, if Elsie disappeared today and we go through the same scenario, there's no doubt in my mind that that case wouldn't be solved immediately.
Do you think you know who killed... I mean, could you say, I think Bill Bailey did it?
I do think that Bill Bailey was responsible, but then I've also... I've been mulling this over for years and years.
I bet.
But I do wonder whether or not, you know, Frank Bailey, who's, you know, the patriarch of the household, you know, he may have had something to do with it too.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Crimes NZ, hosted by me, Jesse Mulligan. And a big thanks to Scott Bainbridge. You can read more about this case and many others in his book, Shot in the Dark. This podcast is produced by Melita Tull, Charlie Drever, Sam Hollis and Ayana Piper-Helian. It's been edited by Grant Walker and Liz Garten. Tim Watkin is executive producer of RNZ Podcasts. You can find Crimes NZ and all RNZ's great podcasts, like the Aotearoa History Show, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many more. It's now also on YouTube.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.